Welcome to SLU Law Summations, presenting brief looks at legal matters that matter to you by St. Louis University School of Law, located in the heart of downtown St. Louis.
The Supreme Court decision banning race-conscious college admissions that was handed down over the summer has rocked higher education and has forced colleges and universities across the country to examine their processes. But the implications of this decision go far beyond campus. The decision has unleashed a new wave of political and legal attacks against corporate America's anti-discrimination policies. Are our hard-fought DEI initiatives in the workforce the next target? What does this mean for educators and employers? In this episode, we are joined by Professor Marcia McCormick, the director of the William C. Weffel Employment Law Center, and Belinda Dantley, the Assistant Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the law school. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. Well, let's dive right in. Or actually, before we get started on like some of the questions that we kind of teased there, let's talk about the decision first. What we talked about briefly, what it doesn't address, but like, what does it address? What kind of, can you give us like a brief overview of like the affirmative action practices that were impacted by this decision?
So this is targeted towards admission offices in higher education that also expand past undergrad. So that means graduate programs as well. And it essentially is telling admission offices that they cannot use race as a determining factor for admitting students. They also cannot have race-conscious practices when it comes to deciding between certain students and who will be enrolled at their institutions. Okay. Is essentially what it is in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And I know that we're going to talk a little bit more about what it doesn't directly address now.
And I feel, and I know you have been working on kind of what, how that applies to our admissions process, the university. So it's still kind of in the realm of figuring out how to apply it, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, we're still absolutely in the realm. Thankfully, our practices were really already in line with the Supreme Court decision was. Because we do a holistic review, it was never just one factor that determined someone being enrolled or accepted into specifically our law school. Mm-hmm. We have changed some things to allow for students to talk more about themselves as a whole student, to allow us to continue that practice of not just focusing on grades or standardized testing scores. So we have expanded the questions that we ask students to include and prompt them on things like their experiences, their instances of growth, their connection to our Jesuit mission and how that would play out in the entering class. So fortunately for us, we have already been doing these things and we have just given applicants the tools to explain that better on our application.
Great. Thank you. So this question is directed more a little to Marcia. Like many decisions with this court, the implications expand far beyond the original audience, right? So Edward Bloom, who is of the Students for Fair Admissions, who, it's my understanding, brought the original cases forward, has now taken aim at law firms, venture capital firms, and federal contracting programs with accusation of racial discrimination. How far do you think these actions will go, and will they have direct impact on employment practices? And I don't know if you're familiar with particularly the nuances of those, I guess, lawsuits, and want to talk about that too as well.
Yeah. So Mr. Bloom has, just as he was sort of the spearheader of Students for Fair Admissions, he's also helped create another nonprofit that focuses on employment opportunities. And that entity is who is suing these, the firms and the venture, the law firms, the venture capital firms, and the federal contracting programs. It's not entirely clear. So the theory of these cases are that, everything that's being sued is using is considering something that Mr. Bloom doesn't like in the process of deciding who is going to work there, or for the venture capital firm, who is going to be funded. Mm-hmm. And so this venture capital firm has, which is run by three Black women, has a program that that provides Black women who own small businesses with $20,000 to essentially use for specific purposes, and then some digital tools and also mentoring. And the allegations are that by only being open to Black women, that the this program essentially discriminates on the basis of race.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it's one of the things that sort of takes this outside. I mean, there are a bunch of things that take this outside of the Students for Fair Admissions case. I mean, one, mm-hmm. there it's not an educational institution.
Right.
Two, it's not governed by the Constitution, although that was sort of the deal in Students for Fair Admissions too. Harvard is a private university. It mm-hmm. doesn't have to comply with the Constitution. The court sort of like glosses over that a little bit, because there's also a federal law that prohibits race discrimination, and the court just basically says, we're just going to consider them the same and only talk about the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there's no constitutional application for any of these employment cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're all being brought, though, under a one of the statutes that was enacted to enforce the 14th Amendment. It's called, and it has just, you know, a name that rolls off the tongue, 42 U.S.C. Section 1981.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Everybody knows that one, right? And it prohibits discriminating on the basis of race in contracting.
Okay.
And so, the ways that they're similar are that they're about whether somebody gets a particular opportunity that comes with stuff,
mm-hmm.
right? So like in the admissions context, it's whether a person gets into school. In these employment contexts, it's whether someone gets the job or gets the funding.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where they're similar. They're very, and maybe the venture capital case is fairly well tied to race. The other things that are being challenged are not as closely tied to race. Mm-hmm. So the fellowship opportunities at the law firms, and there's another law firm that's being sued for its scholarships that it's giving to schools,
mm-hmm.
Basically invited people to apply who identified as members from historically underrepresented groups in the legal profession.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really broad. That includes maybe racial identity or racial ethnicity, and also a broader sense of ethnicity. It also includes sex. Women are actually underrepresented, at least at the highest levels or higher levels of the legal profession. It includes other sexual minorities, so LGBTQI, HIV positive status. All of those kinds of things are within, and students or applicants with disabilities also, right? So all of those people are historically underrepresented in the legal profession. And so I think it might be more challenging to say that race is the thing that has a determinative, a determinative weight in deciding mm-hmm. who gets these fellowships. So if these lawsuits are successful, it will really be expanding the decision way beyond its current contours.
Mm-hmm. And then I know that there was, I don't even know if it was a case or just something that a change in policy with the SBA and their practices with the minority-owned businesses. Is that related to that particular lawsuit? I would assume the one that it sounds a lot like the venture capital one.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the venture capital one. It could be. It could also be. There are a lot of there are some old, I mean, much older or earlier than this case, some old cases about it's not really the Small Business Association, but sort of minority contractor set-aside programs mm-hmm. from the like 1980s and 90s. And so it could be that they're just ensuring too that they have that in light of this decision, that they are really trying to be very careful to conform to what those old cases
right.
provided for.
Right. I imagine that's happening in all sorts of pockets.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So here at the law school, Belinda, our Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, led by Belinda, our Dean Dantley, has worked hard to establish pipeline programs that promote equitable access to law school and work to ensure a more diverse workplace in the legal community. What do you think this case, the implications of it, means for the future of these types of programs?
Again, I'm not entirely worried about the decision in that all of our pipeline programming has been created to increase access to the legal profession and to law school, and doesn't target just students who are from historically excluded races, right? It also mm-hmm. includes first generation students and young people, a part of the LGBTQIA community. It is about creating access to the law school environment and learning mm-hmm. about that process on how to get there, how to be successful, as well as the legal profession and expanding the imagination of young people to include the legal profession in there. What do I want to be when I grow up? Mm-hmm. And it's always about making sure that people from all different backgrounds know that they belong in this space. And so our pipeline programming has never targeted one specific identity or one specific group of people. And therefore, I don't believe that the Supreme Court decision, or really any decision that's even out there right now, that could possibly add to the landscape of the decisions out there, are going to change our practices, because they have already been inclusive and not narrowly focused on one subset or one group or one identity that people have.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that you have worked hard to build relationships with law firms in our community and done a great job at that. Do you think that, you know, as we get further down the line on this, that will be, those conversations will get harder with firms, or will they be, I mean, obviously they'll be very important, but do you think anyone's going to get a little shy, cautious, I should say?
I think there are firms out there that are going to be a lot more cautious or a lot more risk adverse than others. I do, however, believe that, a lot of these firms also have it within their mission of their firm to expand their diversity and to expand the types of representations that they will be able to give to their clients. And I think one of the great things that the Supreme Court decision did focus on was making institutions, which I think will apply later to places of employment, be really intentional about what their mission statements mm-hmm. reflect and what they're saying is important to them, and institutional goals and priorities, and increasing diversity of their students, their faculty, their staff, their employers is not something that is prohibited as a goal and as part of their mission statements. And I believe that that is something that law firms are going to be able to be more intentional about when it comes to creating those types of public statements that they put out there, the types of initiatives that they implement. I think really the Supreme Court decision forces us all to really be more intentional about the words that we use and the programs and policies that we implement.
Yeah, great. Marsha, when we're talking about, you know, the job market and where people in hiring and whatnot, how do you think that will there be any ripple effects from not only the case, but the environment that has been created on hiring practices?
Yes and no. I think employers are inherently sort of conservative about the potential for getting sued.
Right.
And so they tend to be really careful in sometimes over complying with or overreading what the limitations might be in order to comply. But there's a big tension, and Belinda really highlighted that between the mission that a lot of firms have and their economic interest in expanding their client base. that really, you know, sort of require being as open as possible to all kinds of different people becoming associates of the firm or working at the firm. So some of the ways actually that firms are already starting to reframe what it is that they're doing is by focusing on candidates who can describe, who have a commitment to diversity and inclusion, and asking those candidates, for example, to describe that. So shifting from necessarily the identity of the applicant rather to their commitment to the same goals as the employer. Or some are asking people about resilience, the kinds of things that might be demonstrated by being marginalized in particular ways in our society that develop resilience might help accomplish some of the same goals about creating opportunities for people who might not have had opportunities before. And so I think that those are sort of some of the ways that employers are already starting to think about their programs that are designed to be pipeline programs or increase opportunities and their hiring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, Brenda.
I wanted to add to that because I know that initial conversations that I've had with law firms, even when it comes to hiring our students as interns or summer associates and starting to talk to them about, okay, what was the initial reason why we wanted to increase diversity, right? Like why we wanted to at least initially focus on racial and ethnic diversity. What were the benefits as a workforce were we getting from that, right? And again, it allows people to sit down and be intentional. Well, we wanted a difference of perspective. We wanted mm-hmm. a difference of lived experiences so that we can come up with different or better solutions. We wanted people who have had to overcome some things and deal with adversity because that would allow them to take that skill into the workforce when things are getting tough, when caseloads are high, when there's a problem that the firm needs to solve. We have people that are just used to doing that in their life. So having places of employment focus on what are the characteristics, what are the types of qualifications and qualities we want from people, as Marcia said, that can come from having a marginalized identity or being a part of a group of people that have experienced oppression, how then is that going to be a benefit to our workforce?
And there's one key thing about this decision, I think, that really highlights how important that's going to be. And that is that the decision, it's not that the consideration of race was necessarily going to be struck down. It's that the reasons for why race was being considered were not measurable, or the goal wasn't measurable enough for the court to tell when a school would have reached it, or for the school in any sort of like with sort of precision to say when they had reached their goal. When we're talking about a firm's goals for why it is that they want diverse candidates, it's much more likely that those goals are going to be concrete and measurable in terms of, you know, decision making that results in more successful service to our clients, a larger client base, all of those kinds of, or, you know, greater productivity. Any of those things tend to be linked with more diverse groups of decision makers or, you know, more diverse groups that are working on the problem. And so I think it's going to, that the workplace is going to be a very different in terms of the goals and the measurability of them than higher education.
Mm-hmm. So I know you've talked about this in probably some other contexts, Marcia, but there's also like the programming that goes along with not pipeline program per se, but like actually in the workforce, the DEI program. We've heard a lot of conservative rhetoric that goes against that, that kind of targets that. And what do you think, I imagine there's probably some gender-based programming that's going to be targeted as well. I mean, I'm just spitballing here, but what do you think for the future of those kinds of things in like corporate America?
Yeah. I mean, I think there'll be, I don't know that there will be lawsuits, at least at the beginning, because except for to the extent that there might be some mandatory anti-harassment training that includes race discrimination,
mm-hmm.
or there might be some other kind of diversity inclusion training that might be mandatory. So there could be some challenges based on that, but it's not like this program keeps people from opportunities in the way that
right.
an admissions decision keeps people from opportunities. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean there aren't going to be challenges. I just think that it's going to be a lot harder to extend this decision into those areas without something negative, concrete that will happen to a person if they don't do something or if they can't do something.
Right.
And so, but at the same time, I think there's going to be increased appetite for something like Florida's colloquially known Stop Woke Act, which
mm-hmm.
prohibited, it's been enjoined right now by a district court, but it prohibited private employers from mandating diversity and inclusion training.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side, you've got states that mandate sexual harassment training. And sex and race are treated very differently, so there might be a little more flexibility. But of course, there's this huge backlash right now and moral panic surrounding gender and sexuality issues. So it's so hard. It just seems like we're faced with a tsunami of these sort of culturally driven challenges that are being translated into new legislation and litigation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty pervasive, I would say. Are there any other legal challenges that you think are coming down the pipeline beyond what we've talked about?
Well, so I think that probably there will be legal challenges based on sex and sexuality,
mm-hmm.
And that'll be similar to the kinds of challenges for race-based affirmative action. But they'll be a little bit different. So most of the challenges that I've seen that are being made are being are requests to be exempted from compliance with anti-discrimination laws when it comes to discriminating on the basis of sex or sexual orientation and gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we'll continue to see a lot of that. I don't know that we're going to see something challenging affirmative action kinds of things, just because there really isn't a lot of it, or like not limited to those categories. And I think I sort of at least hinted at this, the constitutional analysis is very different.
Right.
And I'm not sure exactly how that would play out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's not all negative.
I want to be clear also that the Supreme Court decision, at least when it comes to higher education, does not focus on scholarships. It is squarely focused on admission decisions, acceptance into the university. However, I could imagine just looking at the follow-up cases that are out there now when it comes to like even like the venture capitalist firms and giving money to certain groups of people, I could see there being some sort of legislation or litigation around scholarships that are identity focused and identity based, whether that is race or sex, that being challenged if they aren't already happening in certain states. But fortunately, we are still able to pay attention to our history of excluding folks from different spaces, including higher education, and how there are additional barriers for certain groups of people financially coming into institutions of higher education, and that we are still able to address those gaps and give scholarships based on lived experiences and identities that our students have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's one other option too, even under this decision and under all the prior equal protection decisions, and an entity can consider race when it is providing some sort of remedy for its own past discrimination. And so, for example, the University of North Carolina could have an admissions program for people who descended from from those enslaved in North Carolina who were, or who were excluded from the university while it was segregated. And that would be linked with race, but that itself would be as a remedy for past discrimination that UNC had engaged in. And that would pass strict scrutiny. So there are other ways that institutions can look at their own past histories and create opportunities to benefit descendants of people who would have been excluded or harmed by those past practices.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I was going to ask, like, my last question was going to be what is the best way forward? And I feel like we've already kind of gotten there in what you're saying, what you've said. Is there anything else that you would want to add to that?
We should remember that this is a very limited decision.
Mm-hmm.
And we should not expand it in our compliance. We should insist on keeping it to the limits that are in the decision itself, and maintain our commitments to providing opportunities for people who may not have historically had those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that we have had diversity, inclusion, belonging, equity initiatives for 50 years at this point. And there has been progress, but very little progress. And I think that decisions like this really force us to do more than just have words on a paper, right? Do more than just focus on the fact that someone is Black or the fact that someone is a woman, and be really intentional about what our mission is, what we are trying to accomplish, and ways that we can do that. And that requires really sitting down and analyzing why we have certain programs, why we have certain scholarships, what goals are we trying to accomplish, and less on we just have this goal or we just have this program or this scholarship. Like we talked about earlier, if we really sit down and analyze why we want diverse workforces, then let's put the things in place to make sure that we capture those benefits that we're going to get. If we really want to have our classes have more diverse perspective, then let's learn about that during the admission process and not just guess that because someone has a certain identity that they are going to be able to have the lived experience to talk about that in a classroom setting. So being more intentional about like the changes that we've made with our application when it comes to, let me actually ask you about your lived experience, mm-hmm. how that is going to shape your classroom experience, and not make the assumption that because you have a marginalized identity that you've had that experience to share.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Well, I think we've covered a lot, guys. Thanks for hanging out with me and talking about this very important and close to our hearts topic. So I appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for joining us for SLU Law Summations, produced by St. Louis University School of Law.